Hello, it's the year 2024. It's me, Matt Stewart, and we've sold out all four of our Do Go Ons live at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. But if you want to see me, you can do that. The show's called Dry Dryer, and we're at a new venue now. It's called The Grace Darling. Me and Sarenjaya Marnett, it's so much fun. The show's getting real good, I reckon. It's been heaps of fun, so we'd love to see you there. Use the discount code Do Go On for cheaper tickets. Also, we've now got the Do Go On quiz show. It's up online on the Stupid Old channel, so please check it out. Getting some lovely feedback so far. Please give it a watch, subscribe to the channel, maybe even comment on it, and, you know, feed those algorithm gods if you can. But love to see a Dry Dryer in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. Check out the quiz show. Anyway, let's get on with this show.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Do Go On. My name is Dave Warnocky and I'm here with Jess Perkins and Matt Stewart. Hello.
Hello.
Good evening.
It's really good to be here.
A pleasure, as always.
You know, I think some people think that this is your show and we're like sort of like permanent
recurring guest hosts. Yeah.
Recurring guests. Oh, that's good.
Don't you think that's weird? Dave, do you want to set the record straight now and just let everyone know that Jess and I are as, if not more, important than you?
Yeah, let them know that we're as, if not more, important than you.
So you're co-stars. So you want, is that what you want?
Even slightly higher stars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No. I think the credits would go, Do Go On, starring Dave Warnocky.
Interesting.
Co-starring Matt Stewart, special guest star.
No. I want an introducing.
Yeah,
I want introducing.
Every week, 100 weeks in a row.
Could we do it like this? Starring Dave Warnocky, introducing Jess Perkins, and as old man, Matt Stewart.
That's great.
My favourite ones are when the last bit of the credits,
yeah,
for some reason, the only one that says, and as, and their character name, for some reason. I never got why that
and
was.
And as TJ Swithers, Matt Stewart. You're like, what?
Yeah.
Who are the others?
Yeah. And as old man.
No, I would like it to be the original Gilligan's Island style, which is, and the rest. The rest were two more people.
Just say brutal. It.
So later on, when the show got popular, they changed and the rest to the Professor and Marianne. But before that, the Professor and Marianne with the rest.
Oh, that's brutal.
They've named six people, and then there's two more. Just name them.
Just name two more. Name them all.
So Dave, Matt, and the rest.
And the jest.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
The jest. You are the jest of the program, aren't you?
Of the program.
Would you call this a program?
Today on today's program.
Let's get cracking with this show. I think it's quite a big report,
okay,
and I think it's a really good one, and holy shit, I'm nervous about it, because it is, my brain was exploding. You know those ones where you're like following rabbits everywhere down the holes, the rabbit holes, and
right.
I was,
down
know,
the holes.
Oh, hang on. So yeah, it's just a real, it was a bit of a sprawling thing. I think I've found a few nuggets in this.
Few nugs.
A few little nuggies, and you know, delicious. So let's get on with it.
Okay.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Well, we do always start with a question, so that would be traditional, yes.
All right. Well, this is basically asking the question, have you guys heard of this topic? But I'll ask the question and see.
And you guys give me shit for not writing questions.
Well, I've written it.
All right. No, well played.
The words are here on the screen.
Okay, yeah, no, can't argue.
because I hadn't heard of this at all.
Okay.
The question is, what secret department did Winston Churchill set up to help win World War II for the Allies?
Winnie Boys. The Winnie Blues.
That's a cigarette brand in
the
Australia.
The Churchill Chaps. Oh my God, I made Matt laugh. You never make Matt laugh. I saw his teeth. Like, he bared teeth.
You should have. I did a web series show the other day. I couldn't stop laughing.
I know. It was the best game. You really laughed. That was nice.
I really laughed. It's nice Adam to Knox see. Was on there. Actually, everyone, Kate Dennett and Evan Munro Smith were all in fine form.
Yeah.
Making me bloody lol hard. Dave, any idea? Do you know it?
Have you heard of the Churchill Chaps?
Gallipoli 2.0, even more fucked than the first time. Because that was all Churchill's fault. Okay.
Was it?
Oh, yeah. He plotted that and really fucked it.
No, what the topic as suggested...
Churchill Chaps.
This wasn't the official name, but this is sort of an unofficial name of it. Mm. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Oh, that is a cool title.
You know what? I'm gonna admit that it's better than Churchill Chaps.
Wow.
It's close.
I'm willing to admit that.
They took them both to focus groups, and they both polled well, but one polled better than the other.
Sure.
This has actually been suggested by a few different listeners, including Lords... Lords, Arambatha, and Dolan. But the reason I am doing this if you could just let me finish the.
What is Lord?
Well, it's someone. Lordus. Lords.
How do you spell that?
L A U R I D S. Lords.
All right. Okay. Fair enough. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Carry on.
But the reason I'm doing this topic today, as I was saying, is because it was put in the Golden Hat by legendary listener. And Patreon supporter, Rowan Epstein.
Rowan!
Rowan, who we have met in real life.
We have.
Appreciated his company in real life. Mm. Hopefully see you at the 100th episode, Rowan.
I feel like he'd be there. If he can, if he's free and if he's available and he can make it, I reckon he'll be there.
Thank you, Rowan.
Thanks awesome. So much for the suggestion. Great suggestion. He suggested it as the ministry.
Is it Epstein?
I think it's Epstein.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I was corrected on that recently, that spelling, the E and the I. Because I grew up in the electorate of Goldstein, and we were shooting a show here with the member for Goldstein, the federal member, Tim Wilson. He was here shooting, and I'm like, I grew up in Goldstein. He's like, actually, it's pronounced Goldstein. The Special Operations Executive is what it was more officially known as.
Special Operations
Executive. So the S-O-E. The Special Operations Executive.
Yeah, I can see why the Ungentlemanly Warfare is really stuck.
Yeah.
It sounds like a movie franchise.
This is closer to what Jess was saying, but some people have called it Churchill's Secret Army, which is pretty close to the Churchill Chaps, which I'm happy to go with if you like.
I want to. Yes, please.
The Churchill Chaps were formed when three secret British war departments merged after the start of World War II. So soon after the start. Mm. These departments were...
How did they know of each other if they were all secret?
Well, the people from above were merging. It was Churchill. Oh, I'm sorry, Jess. That's really... Don't answer seriously. Jess never says anything serious. So the first one was MIR, which was like MI6 and all that. You know, I didn't realize it was MI6, MI5. There's been a bunch of different ones.
Oh.
MIR, MI is military intelligence and the R is research. Oh, fuck, sorry.
Nah, it's all right. I wouldn't have got that.
Which is a department of the War Office that was charged with researching guerrilla warfare. Also, Department EH, which is named after the building it was set up in. So it's pretty boring.
What should we call it? Remember. Hey, that's fine. It says EH.
Yeah.
We got it.
Nailed it.
No one will ever know where our headquarters are either.
And that's lunch.
That was a propaganda organization, which was created by the Foreign Office. And
a company that's a whole job is to come up with like catchy slogans. Let's call it EH.
EH.
Great.
Mm.
In. And then thirdly, Section D, which I like. I love Section D. A propaganda and sabotage arm of the Secret Intelligence Service, a.k.a. SIS, a.k.a. MI6. Wow, I found it hard to say a.k.a. then.
Mm.
Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? Things you learn about yourself.
I can't tell if a.k.a. is part of the title of this. a.k.a. MI6.
Yeah. a.k.a. as in also known as Dave. Keep up, man.
Keep up, man. All right.
But I was confused. I thought it was AKA, AKA MI6. Also known as AKA MI6.
Well, yeah. As of now, it is AKA, AKA MI6.
Sail away, sail away. AKA, AKA, AKA MI6. I'm so sorry.
Little Enya there, Dave. How'd that make you feel? For our Irish listeners.
So sorry.
Though there were some loose arrangements between the three departments, like they were aware of each other, obviously, they overlapped in objectives, you know, some objectives, and at times they even duplicated each other's work, especially the propaganda work of Section D in Department EH. Following the resignation of Neville Chamberlain on May the 10th, 1940, Winston Churchill became the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. This is about 9 months after Britain was already in World War II, which I didn't realise, but I'm not so great with World War II stuff. You are, Dave, though, from memory. You know a fair bit about it.
Oh.
You know much about Nev's work? He lost the confidence of the Parliament and the people a bit. And that's what led to Churchill stepping up.
It's just that he needed to just own it. Just be more confident. Just like fake it till you make it. Mm. You know, you appear confident. People have confidence in you. Do you know what I mean?
I think I do. within a month of taking office, Churchill was working towards combining the three departments into one old super badass war organization. After appointing his Minister of Economic Warfare, Hugh Dalton, with the responsibility of the new organisation, Churchill reportedly said, "And now set Europe ablaze." That's like a famous quote of his about it, apparently.
It's a good one.
"And now set Europe ablaze."
Oh, sir, I just need to remind you that you are technically part of Europe.
Burn us down.
Burn it down.
Stop this room we're standing in right now.
Is that? Have you got matches on you? Okay, let's go.
Because I am an alcoholic and very flammable. He was a big alco guy, wasn't he, Churchill?
I think so.
I think a big drinker, but
big drinker, sorry. Didn't mean to throw words like alco around like that. That's not cool.
Takes one to know one. Yeah.
On the 22nd of July, 1940, the Special Operations Executive was officially formed by Dalton with a charter to sabotage, conduct reconnaissance and espionage in occupied Europe and to help resistance movements on the ground. Dalton is said to have used the IRA's work during the Irish War of Independence as a bit of a blueprint.
So, sorry, sabotage.
Sabotage.
Espionage. Espionage. And what was the middle one?
Conduct reconnaissance.
Nigel Farage.
Of those, sabotage, reconnaissance, and espionage. What's your favourite? Oh, there's three of them. We could have one each.
Well, reconnaissance is fucking boring in comparison.
Sabotage.
A lot more safe.
Yeah, which I feel like is you. You'd be the safe one. You're not going to go in for any espionage, are you?
How do you know I haven't been undercover this whole time?
Come on, mate.
Oh, no.
In that outfit?
It's just so crazy, it might be believable. No one would dress like that. Really?
No one would behave the way he does.
Yeah, I reckon they would. In November 1940, as the Nazi Air Force, the Luftwaffe...
Great, great phrase, isn't it?
It is great.
Luftwaffe.
It's not quite right, is it? I'm not doing quite nail it.
No, it's Luftwaffe.
It's 99 Luftwaffe balloons. As the Luftwaffe was bombing central London, the Special Operations Executive set up its headquarters in two flats on Baker Street.
Baker Street?
Oh, no, that's not... What was that? Chicago.
You want...
I went the wrong way. Yeah, that's the one I was here for.
His face is the best.
When he converts it into a sax...
What are his lips doing? Why can't he make eye contact with us?
That was my impression of a man who hadn't played the saxophone in 50 years, picking it up for the first time. I think I remember a song.
And it was interesting. So this is where they set up. Right. This is all interesting. I was about to go off on a tangent. I've written so many, I don't need to go off onto others. From this base, they began to recruit agents. According to a Nigel Morris article for the BBC, he said, senior staff at the SOE were invariably ex-public school and Oxbridge. Which I didn't know what it meant. I looked it up. Public school in the UK means private school.
Oh, that's private school. So they're all wealthy, tough types.
And Oxbridge means Oxford and Cambridge. Oh, so, yeah, so they're all sort of the exclusively educated types.
Because you can trust them. Because if they're already rich, they're happy, right?
They're not going to, like, they're not motivated by money because they already have money.
Exactly.
Can't, like, you can't bribe them because they're like, that's pocket change for me. Are you kidding?
I think it's... yeah, well, that's just the top brass anyway. That's the officers and that sort of stuff. But he goes on to say that the agents came from all walks and included a former chef, an electrician, several journalists, and the daughter of a Brixton motor car dealer.
That's pretty cool.
It does say, at first I thought it was going to be like, guys, we've got people from all walks of life. Greg knows a chef. So
his personal one.
Guys. He only just got into Oxford.
I really thought...
Like, so, he's pretty average.
I really thought Jess, you might have the last one there. It was...
She's the daughter of
this is a woman who probably has her own things, but she's listed here because her dad sold cars.
Mm.
So weird. Oh, her dad did a job.
Oh, she's in.
It just seemed really funny to me. Anyway.
Yeah. I noticed you looked straight at me and I was like...
Because normally, whenever someone said, and his wife, you'd be like, what's the fucking wife's name? So I thought it might have been a similar scenario, but I was wrong. I had written in there, pause for Jess to go on rant.
The podcast will now be 10 minutes shorter than expected.
So anyway, it was a bit of a cross-section of society. As missions were undertaken behind enemy lines, so this is what it was all about. It was about little guerrilla crews going behind enemy lines and... just fucking shit up.
All right, so we've got Sarah here. Her dad owns a car dealership. How can we best use her skills? All right, we'll send her into Berlin and she'll take a car for a spin. And when it's out, she'll put a bomb underneath it. Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, good.
Does she speak German? Nah. Don't need it.
Can she drive? Nah.
Nah, no, but her dad does, so it's all about her dad.
Interesting you mentioned that. Obviously, it was important that the agents had a deep knowledge of the country where they would operate. They needed to speak the language fluently.
Yeah, she speaks car. Right? She goes into the dealership, Guten Tag, and she just goes, brum brum, brum, me, brum brum. Oh.
Welcome.
Welcome to my city, brum brum.
Do you sprecken the broom?
Conan the broom sprecken?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
In at this time, if they were dual citizens, that was seen as a real bonus. Mm. Obviously, because you don't need to forge passports and documents that way. The SOE was ahead of the game with its use of women in armed combat.
Fuck off.
As those sent into the field were trained to use weapons and in unarmed combat.
But, I mean, they're still wearing aprons while they do it, so it's okay.
But at the time, they would normally make them wear two aprons. So it was seen as being progressive, just the one.
And pretty dangerous, too.
Mm.
Of their 55 female agents that they had over through the war, 13 were killed in action or in Nazi concentration camps. So they were seeing active, dangerous action, which, you know, across the rest of the army at that stage wasn't happening as much, I believe.
Wow.
But like I say, I don't fucking know anything.
Hey, you were
around.
What
are you listening to me for? I was around, but I was hiding in a bunker. Real weird thing happened towards the end of the war. This guy with a little mustache came in. Couldn't understand a word he was saying. But he was there with his niece.
Was he just...
fucking like nobody's business, I think. I was trying not to look. Anyway, ended up with a bullet in his brain. Weird chap. Weird guy.
Was he brooming at you?
He was even brooming at me.
Wow.
Well, that's the best joke of the pod.
While this recruitment process is happening, this guy that I like mainly for his name, but he also seems like he's one of those classic war guys that we've been talking about through past episodes where they're just those sort of badass guys. His name is Colonel Colin Gubbins.
Gubbins.
Which is pretty cool.
Fuck yeah.
Colin's a badass name, isn't it?
Colin. Is that the name of your car?
Yes. And it's a pretty cool car.
It is a cool car, yeah. The Gubbins. It was mainly the Gubbins.
All right. And bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? Colin's here to fuck shit up.
Not Colin. He's got a real reputation.
Gubbins. Anyway. He was SOE's head of training and operations, and he started turning properties and mansions across the UK into agent training bases. So according to Morris, new agents were taught how to kill with their bare hands, how to disguise themselves, how to derail a train, and even how to get out of a pair of handcuffs with a piece of thin wire and a diary pencil. If an agent survived these tests and a grueling parachute course, they were ready to go. They love parachutes in this. A lot of parachuting in. A lot of these missions were parachute in.
But not many parachuted out.
Which no. is interesting.
It was quite difficult, yeah. Even with a pencil diary.
Yeah, they just didn't get it. They taught and they taught real hard. They taught hard. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. Colin, he teaches hard.
Yeah.
I love the idea that they think that they'll always have a diary pencil on hand. It's obviously. Well, when you're in handcuffs, they'll expect you to keep a journal.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to write.
Dear diary, day 3.
Still cuffed. Hang on. It's been in my hands all along. SOE also employed scientists to invent weapons of war in what Morris describes as the 007 factor. Uni grads working for the SOE invented devices such as the single-shot cigarette pistol and the Sleeping Beauty, which was a submersible canoe. SOE workshops also created carborundum, which was an abrasive grease that could bring a steam train to an immediate standstill.
How?
They invented carborundum.
Wait, grease.
Grease, yeah.
It
apparently,
was a type of grease that's
but it was abrasive
it.
Grease. So apparently if there was a certain way that they rubbed it onto the tracks.
Rub it the wrong way, eh?
Yeah, you rub
the train the wrong way.
Yeah. And you'll stop it dead in its tracks.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So yeah, it's sort of fun, like all these just like going, invent some cool shit. They also had a camouflage section, which was run by a film director named Elder Willis.
I can see you! You have failed!
He oversaw a team of movie prop makers. So I love it, it's just people from everywhere coming in. Many simple yet ingenious items were created, such as a fake tree trunk mold that could conceal radio equipment, and fake camel shit that was actually a booby trap.
Okay.
So okay, it looks like camel shit, and you drop it in the, you know.
What, in Berlin?
In Berlin.
Downtown or Berlin with the camels.
What? And then what? If somebody goes over and is like, huh, let me inspect this pile of camel shit?
No, it's like, you know, like a mine. So you'd put camel shit on the road, and cars or whatever
shit.
Are happy to drive over them. But
bang.
Now, what they'd really do is they'd get camel shit, and inside there'd be dog shit. So the people inspecting the camel shit, they'd be like, this is just camel shit, this is dried up. They'd pick it up, it would crumble, and then they'd get dog shit on their shoes.
Shit would crumble, and it'd be human shit.
Yeah.
Their own, somehow. And it'd freak them out, and they'd be like, all right, I'm out.
Trippy. How would they know it was their own shit?
Oh, you don't know your own shit?
Jess, I could recognize my shit in a lineup of 100.
You could, Dave.
Someone will lead me blindfolded to a mystery location, so I don't recognize where I am. I'll shit. I'll trust you to lead me to a safe place. I will shit into a receptacle. You can take a photo of it.
I don't want
to
do that.
And then we'll swap it in with 99 other photos, and I'll be able to pick mine.
Okay, I'm...
To prove that World War II exists.
Hey, he's dedicated to the cause, and I appreciate that, but I shotgun not taking a picture of Dave's shit.
All right, Matt will take the photo. Jess will hold the receptacle.
Damn it!
The
this tiny tush.
Yeah, you'll have to be...
It's a plastic bag.
I'll have to be pretty accurate.
Does that make sense?
Well, we'll have to be... Or a large receptacle. Either or.
Stop.
But don't tell me what you're planning, because I don't want to recognize it. All right. I appreciate science, unlike you.
Yeah, Jess, wake up.
Sorry, you're right. You love poo, Chad.
Matt, poo go on.
The Secret Intelligence Service, now known as the MI6, viewed SOE with great suspicion. The head of the Secret Intelligence Service, Sir Stuart Menzies, wasn't into the work of the SOE at all. He would describe them as amateur, dangerous, and bogus, and campaigned internally against them. But as they were the baby of Prime Minister Churchill, they were...
Give it a free pass.
They were pretty much, yeah, they were... As long as Churchill was in charge, they were all good.
Churchill's chaps.
They're the chaps, after all. And?
Chepets.
So...
Chepinas.
The SOE, it's got three spy military organisations, but not MI6.
No, not MI6. Well, no, those sort of all dissolved into this one. So it's now the one thing. MI6 is still separate.
Right, and they're criticising the SOE. Right.
Yeah. Mm. They're not into it. Because, I mean, it's to them, it's like... Because they are amateurs. They're literally amateur. No, they're not. They are getting paid a wage. They're literally not amateurs, but they're not well-trained.
Right, they're like film directors. And...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The SOE undertook, or the chaps undertook missions right across the war in numerous countries. One example, I'm going to go into a few of them because I thought maybe it was the best way to talk about it. Because there were hundreds of missions, so I've just picked out a few to talk about, and hopefully that'll give you a bit of an idea. So one example was Operation Josephine B, also known, apparently, as Operation Josephine. So, like, anyway, it's like a couple of wildly different names there. Seems confusing. If there are no other lettered Josephines, let's just call...
Yeah.
I reckon the MI6 is right. These are a bunch of amateurs.
So this was in 1941. It was jointly organized with Free France, which I hadn't heard of. You know, Free France was the name of the French government in exile led by Charles de Gaulle, which was set up in London in June 1940. Charles de Gaulle being the big train station in Paris, one of them.
You mean airport?
Airport, fuck. So this mission was jointly organised with Free France, and the aim of the mission was to blow up the Pessac power station, which was an important piece of infrastructure for the Axis of Evil. The station was difficult to reach by air, but the plan was to drop a small team nearby via parachute.
Oh, the traditional method. Subtle.
From there...
Yeah, they're never looking at the skies.
Never.
Looking at the ground.
Look at their bloody phones.
They'll be digging up through the ground like moles at any second.
Nah, we're dropping from the skies.
From there, they would break into the station, leave bombs with delayed timers, destroying the bloody joint. That's the plan, right? You feeling sorry for the... Tell me you're not feeling any sympathy for the...
The Axis of Evil.
Jess?
Well, I mean, they've got families.
Yeah, Nazi families.
Yeah, Nazi children. Nazi dogs. I had a customer the other day at my job whose name was Swastika.
No.
Yeah.
First name.
First name. And I was like, I definitely heard that wrong. So later in the conversation, I was like, I'm sorry, what was your name? Can you spell that for me? And it was Swastika.
What was the surname? Smith?
That's someone who's chosen it for himself.
Do you reckon?
Or herself. Yeah, there's no way that parents would have named you that and you grew up and don't go, I'm changing that name. That's someone who's definitely...
I think. Obviously, I think it was a cultural thing. But yeah, you would think you would change your name.
The team was made up of 6 Polish volunteers who were trained up for the mission. They set off from a Royal Air Force base near Chichester in West Sussex. But due to a technical fault, a bunch of their equipment was accidentally dropped over the Loire River. The Loire in France. It's like a big river there. I've never seen... How would you say that?
Loire.
The Loire. Dropped over the Loire in France, and they had to turn back. The mission was off to a poor start, you could argue.
Mm.
I will argue. Okay, we'll argue after I say, only got worse when their plane crash-landed on their return, killing some crew and wounding all the volunteers.
Laughed a little bit too early there.
Yeah, yes, you did. Yes, you did.
So I hear plane crash and I think, this is going to end very funnily.
What a mess.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so that was just a big old failure. So a second team was put in place. They were keen to make this happen, obviously. This time with Free French forces, so people from the French nationals, including Sergeant J. Foreman, Sub-Lieutenant or Sub-Lieutenant Raymond Cabard, and Sub-Lieutenant or lieutenant, Andre Varnier, a.k.a. Jacques LeBlanc.
I was going to say, these are the least French names ever until the a.k.a. came in.
Jacques
First guy's LeBlanc. Name was John Foreman.
J. Foreman. No, initial John. J. I reckon it was short for Jacques.
John Foreman. John. What was the last name? Jacques LeBlanc.
Jacques LeBlanc.
Love it.
Love that.
Which means the white, the black, the white.
It's white.
Blanc white.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether it's your first ever website or your business is expanding, Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website and engage with your audience.
Jess, before you jump in, Dave, can you say entrepreneurs again? It sounds so good.
Entrepreneurs.
Oh my God.
God, he's good.
Jeez.
If it feels a bit overwhelming to start your own website, don't worry. You can get help with written content on your website with Squarespace AI. Generating instant, personalized results that know and show your brand identity. You explain what your site's about, you choose your tone, you enter what you need, and you get short and long form text. How cool is that?
Oh my God, can Squarespace just do my life?
It'd be good if it could do my taxes.
Hey, you can easily manage your clients and invoices. Two things that I definitely have, from vetting leads to receiving payment via invoices in one streamlined and customizable workflow.
Sorry, Matt, can you pronounce streamlined for me again?
Streamlined.
Beautiful.
Was that closer?
Yeah, in that it was the word.
Okay.
And not streamlined. You can also sell exclusive content on your site by adding a paywall to sell membership or courses, or you can sell files that your customers can download, like PDFs, music, ebooks.
Right, Jess, can I just get you to say the word courses again?
Courses.
Nailed it. Head to squarespace.com/dogoon for a free trial and to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/dogoon.
Oh my God.
So that was selected for the mission. So a small team of three this time instead of the six initially. And I was sent to stations.
You could say that's half the size of the team.
It was half the size. They downsized for sure.
Who's getting better at math? Not me. Yeah, you're right.
No, you did real well there, Jess.
Thank you.
So I was sent to Station 17 for training in industrial sabotage by inventor, engineer, and soldier Cecil Vanderpeer Clark.
Oh, the Clark ruined it a little bit, didn't it?
CVC. I'm just going to call him Cecil.
Yeah.
He was an interesting guy, this Cecil guy. An inventor, an engineer, a soldier. This guy did it all. And he was one of the big dogs.
A lover.
In the chaps. No doubt about that. He was an interesting guy. He grew up in London and was known to his friends as Nobby. In between serving...
known to his very close friends as Nobby.
In between serving in the First and Second Wars, he worked as a director at a motoring company in Bedford, where he registered patents relating to engine design. So he's, you know, he's somewhat of a go-getter, the engineering kind of guy, inventing, very industrious. This guy had it all.
Mm-hmm.
Soon after, he designed his own engine, but shelved the project when he realized...
shelved the project?
Wow.
Up the butt, if that's what... Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
An entire engine. An
entire engine.
Up the butt.
Up the butt. He became more machine than man. And that's where it took a real turn.
It was a different time, wasn't it?
It was a different
time. He started speaking car. But not out of his mouth. Let me just say that.
Out of his butt?
Yeah, brum, brum, brum.
Brum, brum, indeed.
So he shelved that project because he realized that larger companies would be able to make it happen more economically than he could. He then started his own company designing trailers. And caravans as well. And the editor of the Caravan and Trailer magazine met with Cecil for an interview and later described his first impressions of the inventor, saying, "Clark at once fascinated me. He was a very large man with rather hesitant speech, who at first struck me as being amiable but not outstandingly bright. The second part of this impression did not last long.
Right, so he
was bright.
He was bright.
He's got to be, right? He's inventing all this stuff.
But he doesn't seem bright.
He didn't say, because he's just the way he talks slow and stuff.
Sounds like someone else we know, doesn't it, Dave? Talks a bit slow. Amiable, but not bright, you know?
Yeah, a big man.
Big man.
Large.
Mm.
It's on the tip of my tongue. Is it the guy, is it Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, that's who we're talking about. I was going
to say the guy who was once California's governor.
His biggest claim to fame.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know him from that?
Yeah.
His life in politics.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, the politician.
Yeah, the politician.
The famous American politician.
Who had an affair with his nanny.
Yeah.
From Flushing, Queens. She was there to sell makeup, but they saw more.
A lot more.
She had style.
Mr. Chef. Mr. Schwarzenegger. this probably...
Oh, Miss Fine. That was my auntie.
This podcast hasn't gone to the bloody depths of comedy.
It's fine.
He writes Broadway musicals.
But he could never quite reach the heights of
Andrew Lloyd Webber. Andrew Lloyd Webber. Oh, he had a big rivalry with Andrew Lloyd.
Him and Arnold Schwarzenegger. So this all probably seems like a bit of a weird tangent. I don't know if you noticed that I just started going into a backstory.
Oh, about the trailer man.
Yeah. But
Cecil
and McRae, the editor, would meet again in 1939. At this point, McRae was now editor of a popular science magazine.
He'd moved up from the Caravans and Trailers magazine. Dream job, by the way.
Do you think the background there is that there was a caravan magazine and a trailer magazine? They didn't have enough market, so they merged. I think that's what's happened.
That's possible.
I would like to say that's a fact.
The 30s were a different time.
Mm.
Trailer mag.
McRae contacted Cecil... after being contacted himself by Major Millis Roland Jefferis of the War Office.
Jefferis. I heard your teeth click then. Jefferis.
And this guy had read an article in McRae's science magazine about powerful magnets. The Major wanted McRae to create a kind of explosive that could be magnetically adhered to things like ships under the water. And McRae asked Cecil to help make this happen.
A magnetic explosive.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So I could, you know, just stick it under big warships. Cecil agreed, and they set to work. Does that make sense as a phrase?
Yeah.
Great. Making prototypes.
Big, amiable, not that bright.
Mm. Needs encouragement.
So they started making prototypes with large tin bowls purchased from a local department
Aldi.
Store. It was actually Woolworths, but anyway. And using porridge in place of explosives in the early things. It sort of sounds more like they're making breakfast to me.
Porridge in
the bowls.
The part of explosives will be played by porridge.
But that's not how you make explosives.
Suicide bomber rips open their jacket and they're just covered in porridge.
They're damp with porridge.
Give me the cash or everyone dies. Sir, are you covered in porridge?
Did you spill your
Do
breakfast?
Do what he says. Do what he says.
He looks unhinged.
They're rolled oats.
Rolled oats.
Anyway, they kept working on it and eventually invented this new kind of mine and named it the limpet mine after the sea snail, known for its ability to adhere to rocks. So quite similar to the bombs, obviously, in that way. The limpet mines also had a delay mechanism so that after it had been put in place, the soldier would have time to get away before the explosion. And that is where the sea creature and the mines differed.
Sea creature had no timer.
You wrote that joke, didn't you? You fucking wrote that down.
Yeah, I wrote that one down. The sea snail didn't have a delay mechanism, nor did they explode, admittedly.
Oh, two differences.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Wait. When you wrote that today, presumably, did you...
I wrote two jokes in this report. That was the first of them.
Oh, there's another one coming.
Yeah, I can't remember where, but there...
That was a two-parter there.
Soon after the limpets had been invented and manufactured... World War II broke. So I've taken you back a step.
Oh, it broke.
So they're preparing for World War II.
This is before the army came and they sort of know shit's going down, you know, pre-World War II.
It broke. How are they going to stick it back together? Bit of sticky tape.
The World War.
When you broke your mum's vase. Vase.
The Limpet mines were used in many raids in the war, including Operation Jaywick. In September 1943, a small team of Allied commandos raided Japanese shipping in Singapore Harbour, paddling into the harbour, then placing the mines onto multiple ships, sinking or seriously damaging 7 Japanese ships.
Nice one.
So these things that started with bowls of porridge ended up like having...
Sinking ships.
Sinking ships.
Tell you what, I've had bowls of porridge that have had a similar effect on me.
Loose lips sink ships. Uh-huh. And you fill those lips with porridge, you're gonna be sunk.
Mm-hmm. That's how the saying goes.
It is. Anyway, back to Operation Josephine B, which...
Oh my God, we started talking about 14 minutes ago.
So the 3-man team from Free France were sent to Station 17 for training under Cecil.
So this is second plan. Second group, because the Polish people crashed.
Yes, the Polish people crashed. This is Team 2, the French. Under Cecil, they learnt well, and they set off on the night of May 11th, parachuting in. They hid their container of equipment, which included these smaller shape-charged limpets that Cecil taught them how to use, I assume. Don't know that for sure, but I guess so. The plan was to obtain bicycles to make a silent getaway. But when they were unable to do so, they couldn't source bicycles. And they also found that the perimeter wall was harder to get over than first thought.
You certainly couldn't ride a bicycle over it.
Because there was a high voltage wire inside the top of the 9-foot wall. So you had to scale this quite large wall, and then there was a high voltage electric wire that you had to somehow get over as well. So they kind of got a bit disheartened. Remember, this is the power station we're trying to blow up.
Yeah, yeah.
That was so long ago that I mentioned that you might have forgotten. But that's what they're trying to do here. They're trying to fuck that shit up. So they were a bit disheartened by these setbacks, and the 3 Frenchmen abandoned the mission and set off for Paris.
Where we will drink wine.
Which was, you know, Nazi occupied, I'm pretty sure. Wasn't it? Oh, yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yes, but depending
on
what
period.
That's why
Free France is in.
Yes, it must be then, this period then.
Yeah. One of the men, Sergeant J. Foreman, the most French of them all.
John Foreman.
Foreman.
He'd been given an address to go to, if need be, in Paris, where allies would be. And at that address, he met Joel Letuc, a member of the Free French. He had recently had to abandon a mission himself. This is old mate Letuc. He had to abandon a mission himself recently because of outdated intel. So when he heard that they had abandoned their mission for like kind of less concrete reasons, he rallied the team and convinced them to head back and complete their mission.
Guys, it's just a wall.
He also went along with them to make sure it happened. So all of a sudden, now the team is 4. The new plan was to commandeer a truck to head up to Passac, where the power plant was. But when the truck broke down, they had bicycles instead. So they now had bicycles, and they rode there. Found the explosive where they'd hidden them a while back now, nearly a month ago, and found they were still in working order. Still good to go. On the night of June 7th, almost a month after they had initially meant to carry out the mission, they were going to have a crack. Sergeant J. Foreman scaled the perimeter wall and was able to make it over while avoiding contact with the electric wire. He was then able to let the rest of the team in with their explosives by opening a door.
It's good stuff. It's a good plan.
It's because of the training of Colin that he was like, I know what to do here. Mm. I'm going to open that door.
I'm used to several different types of handle. Wood, ivory, and one other.
But I'll never tell. That's this organization's greatest secret.
That's it.
Mm.
The bombs were put in place in under half an hour, and the 4 men made their getaways via the bicycles.
The 4 men, including 4 men.
4 men, including Foreman, yeah.
I was thinking the same thing, DW. Oh, my God.
So they set the bombs, set the timers.
Get on their bicycles.
Got on their bicycles. And as they're riding away.
Oh, awesome.
Behind them, the skies lit up with the explosions. It was a success.
Wow.
Which is just an image that I love. Mm. These guys pedaling fast. Yeah, reading their little bells.
I like to imagine there's a basket on the front of one of them and they've got a baguette in there, you know, for later.
party. That was when I was in France. I've been a couple of times. That was the one, like, old school bad French cliche that is true. There's people walking around with baguettes everywhere. Mm-hmm. No berets.
No berets.
No blue and white horizontal striped t-shirts. No red bandanas.
A lot of baguettes, though.
But baguettes are everywhere, which was the best because I fucking love them.
My
baguettes
friends,
with, like, mustard and some sort of a cheese.
So much cheese. We just ate a lot of, like, we'd get a baguette and some brie and just, like, sit. We had a baguette fight underneath the Eiffel Tower while wearing berets.
You guys are the worst.
You're the worst kind of Australian.
You could really get arrested for that.
Yeah.
They did not take kindly to that.
Nah.
Look at those clearly foreign people.
Yep. Look at those.
Taking the piss out of
tourist
us.
Tourist assholes.
And our great proud culture.
Yeah. Now, come over here and fight me with that baguette.
6 of the intended 8 Transformers were destroyed. And as a result, work at the enemy's U-boat base. U-boats are the...
It's a German
submarines.
Submarines, what they call them, yeah.
So that their U-boat base
underboat, I get it.
In Bordeaux was severely hampered, as was an electric train system in the southwest of France, which had to be replaced entirely by steam trains. So it was just they wiped out the use of a whole train system.
That is great. That's and cool. Now they just put a little bit of grease on the track. Yeah. Suddenly the steam trains stop.
But steam trains are just so pretty, you know?
Yeah.
Terrible for the environment.
Something quite beautiful about them, except the bad for the environment bit. Yeah, you know? You don't get that in an electric train.
Yeah, electric trains just don't sound like owls.
No. You know when an electric train goes past and goes like, oh, I hate that. Give me a hoot, hoot any day. Give me a hoot any day.
Okay. So the mission was a success.
That's great. I love it.
Mission codenamed Josephine B.
Josephine B. Or possibly just Josephine.
Mm.
So from there, the team were ordered to head for Spain. They asked to be come and collected by a submarine or something. That was the original plan, was they were going to be come and picked up in a submarine or something and taken back away.
Mm.
But they missed that chance when they fled to Paris. And this time around, they just said, no, you make your own way to Spain, please. Which they did, but they took their time, around 2 months, enjoying their journey, reportedly spending 250,000 francs along the way, which is around, is over 100,000 grand in
today's
money.
100,000 grand.
In 2 months.
$100 million.
100,000 grand.
Did I say 100,000 grand? Sorry about that. Take the grand bit out.
Just 100,000. That's still a shitload of money.
We're 4 people just... Hey, I love that idea.
I reckon,
like,
we did it.
And everyone back at home is just like rationing like crazy.
Yeah, I don't. That's interesting. How do they get that money? But I think probably Churchill like really threw a lot of money.
It's probably like emergency money.
Yeah.
And they're just like, well,
this is an emergency.
It's World War II.
Yeah.
If you need to put down a deposit on a home as an emergency, here is a secret fund. Sub-Lieutenant Raymond Cabard was captured on the journey back to Spain. But the other 3 made it to Spain and eventually back to England.
They spent his share of the money.
But Cabard escaped as well and ended up back with the SOE-2. In the aftermath of the mission, that's all fun. Everything up to that point
is a good
amount of fun.
Uh-oh.
But as it often happens, the Nazis come in and make it all a little less fun.
Mm, I always ruin it.
In the aftermath of the mission, the Nazis, they didn't take it well. they didn't know how it happened. So they took it out on the locals. There were fines, 250 locals were jailed, and a curfew was imposed, 9:30 PM till 5 AM. Lockout laws. It's probably like
Sydney all over again.
Sydney all over again. I think that's even harsher than Sydney's, I think. And a dozen German soldiers who were on duty guarding the station at the time were shot.
That is harsher than Sydney.
That's a little harsher than Sydney. When news of the success of the mission reached Britain, Hugh Dalton, one of the top dogs. Yeah, one of the top dogs. He's in Parliament, but he's the guy that Churchill gave the responsibility for this whole thing to. Hugh Dalton passed the news on to the PM, Churchill, writing, "We may therefore take it as practically certain that 3, obviously 4, doesn't matter. He thinks it was three, but it was four. That three men dropped from an aeroplane have succeeded in destroying an important industrial target. This strongly suggests that many industrial targets, especially if they cover only a very small area, are more effectively attacked by special operations executive methods rather than air bombardment.
Oh, right. So,
they saw that as like, oh, this is good for us. This is a big win for the SOE. The triumph of the mission helped prove that guerrilla operations like this could play a key role in disrupting the German war machine and lead to many, many more similar initiatives.
Hmm.
So that's that one. Here's another one. You want to hear about another one?
Nah.
I'm in.
Gee, that could really be the episode, but I've got some more.
Yeah.
Another one they were involved in was called Operation Anthropod. Anthropod.
That's how Scheinberg would say it.
The target of this one was Reinhard Heydrich. Are you familiar with him?
No, but I like his name.
Reinhard.
He was the target of it.
I don't think we like this person.
Adolf Hitler described him as the man with the iron heart.
Whoa, Hitler said that about him.
Yeah.
And Hitler, not the warmest guy, is he?
No, he was a real bad guy.
And whoa.
So that language is a little bit soft. He was a c***.
Strong word.
Oof. Wow. Haven't had one of those for a while.
Two episodes.
Amongst many other roles, he was in charge of the Einsatzgruppen, which was a special task force that it followed behind the German armies, gassing and shooting everyone in their wake. Including over 2 million people, 1.3 million of them being Jews.
Whoa.
He was like a massive... I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. This high-up Nazi was a fuckhead. Heydrich had...
Controversial opinion there.
Controversial, sure.
Mm.
Heydrich had been sent to Prague in what was then Czechoslovakia on September the 27th, 1941... and he was appointed Deputy Reich Protector of the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia.
Oh, my God. Put that on a business card. Fucking hell.
That was, you know, that's that area. Bohemia is sort of like takes in a bunch of that sort of stuff.
Bohemia sounds nice. You know?
It is like a
beachy area.
It is now.
You know?
Under Nazi rule, it probably wasn't.
Probably was nice before they came along, too. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. The actual head Reich Protector, Konstantin von Neurath, was officially still the head of the region, but it was in name only, and he was sent on leave because Heinrich Himmler, and Heydrich felt that he was too soft on the Czechs.
Whoa.
Upon his appointment, Heydrich reportedly said, "We will Germanize the Czech vermin." He began suppressing Czech culture, like almost instantly, closing down any sort of avenues which the Czech people would express their cultural identity. Different, you know, cultural organizations, those sort of things.
Podcasts, for example.
Podcasts would be one of the... He probably would have done that, yeah, I reckon. Podcasts would probably want... I wonder how that would work. Anyway, he also began executing members of the Czech resistance. Within 3 days of his arrival in Prague, he had organized the execution of 92 people. According to Heydrich's own estimate, more than 4,000 people were arrested in his first 4 months there. Many were executed and others were sent to concentration camps, and he quickly earned the nickname the Butcher of Prague.
Oh, that's not a good nickname at all. And you know I love nicknames, but I don't like that one.
Yeah, this guy, it just feels like pure evil.
Yeah.
And I guess that's part of the reason why he became a target of SOE's Operation Anthropoid.
Would he also be the inspiration for Hydra in Captain America?
Yeah, I think who was it? Red Skull. Is that based on someone from? I'm asking Dave. Like,
are you looking at me? I haven't even seen the Captain America movie.
Oh yeah, man, you gotta see Captain America.
I'm sure he would have been based on some of the, maybe surely, all of them, or maybe one of them. Maybe Himmler. Himmler's like. He was a comic book evil guy, really, wasn't he?
Mm.
Dave,
watch Captain America, please.
All right, I'll do it for you.
Really good movie.
For no one else.
Anyway, the operation was the brainchild of Franciszek Morawiecki.
There's some tough names in here, but you're doing really well.
But he's a good guy. We're talking...
Yes.
Anthropoid.
So he's the anthropoid guy. He was the head of the Czech intelligence services. Morawiecki briefed Colin Gubbins, our man.
Colin.
Of the SOE, as we told. At this time, apparently, he was a brigadier and in charge of the Czech sections of the organisations.
Brigadier.
Gubbins was keen to help. On you, Colin. Moravec handpicked a team of 24 from the 2,000 available Czech soldiers based in Britain at the time, and they went on to train at an SOE training camp in Scotland. The main men were a Slovak named Josef Gabčík and a Czech named Karol Svoboda. Look, obviously, I'm confident none of these names are quite right. I'm having a crack.
You're really having a
crack. Sorry, for any offense caused. The mission, if their families are listening, could you at least get his fucking name right? The mission was set to go down on the 28th of October 1941. This was Czechoslovakia's Independence Day, I think. But it was delayed when Svoboda suffered a head injury while training, which meant he had to be replaced. And a replacement was found, a man named Jan Kubis, or Jan, or Jan, or Jan. Gabčík and Kubis, along with a team of soldiers, flew out from Britain to Czechoslovakia. They had to wait. It was delayed because he had to finish training. This guy was stepping in. He had to get trained up, and also they had to get his forged documents ready and stuff like that.
Sure. All the paperwork.
All the paperwork.
And he had to give 2 weeks' notice at his last place, so they had to wait for him to be able to start.
That's
right. Training. And then the week that they started training, there was a public holiday, so then they kind of pushed him back a day. It takes a while. You know what it's like.
You know. Admin, hey? Bloody red tape. So they flew out to Czechoslovakia. Once they had landed, they headed to Pilsen, which is where Pilsner beer is from, and they contacted some embedded allies before heading to Prague, where the assassination plot was meant to occur.
Uh-oh. I don't like the word meant to in that sentence.
Words.
After abandoning a couple of planned attempts, they settled in on a plan to kill Heydrich while he was driving from his Czech home to Prague Castle, which I think was his place of business.
Of course, he's got an evil lair.
Yeah, you're right.
Should see a photo of him. Prague Castle. What does it mean? There's a clue in that.
Yeah.
I think Prague Castle was already there before he...
Nope. Prague-sel. Pretzel.
So that was his daily commute, you know, driving to the castle every day.
The pretzel.
Gabčík and Kubis chose a spot along the route where they knew he would have to slow down. It was on a bend in the road, so they're like, this is where we're going to take him out. On the 27th of May 1942 at 10:30 a.m, Heydrich and his driver left for the castle in his Mercedes convertible. What a leisurely start of the day, eh?
Convertible?
10:30 a.m. He's got a convertible.
Yeah.
Starting work at 10:30, leaving the house at 10:30, so probably, you know, by the time you get to work, get your cup of coffee. Yeah. Yeah, check your emails. He's not starting proper work till at least 11:15 at the absolute earliest.
Yeah.
What a leisurely day. I bet he knocks off early too, eh?
It's classic.
3 o'clock, he's out the door.
So the car reached the curve a few minutes later, and Gabčík jumped out in front of the car with his Sten submachine gun.
Oof.
He attempted to open fire, but the gun jammed.
No!
Have they been planning this for months? So what the plan is... Jump in front of the car and start shooting.
What's the training? The parachuting.
The training should be how to get the gun to work.
Yeah,
that hasn't worked.
That'd be a key bit of their training. But maybe this next part was part of the training. They stopped the car so that Heydrich could shoot Gabčík with his pistol. So so the driver Klein stopped the car. So they're like, oh, what's this idiot?
So he just stood up with a pistol and shot him.
That was the plan, but before he could, Kubis pulled out a grenade from his bag and threw it at the Merc. It went bang.
Oh, my God.
Good throw?
It was a pretty good throw. It sent shrapnel into Heydrich, but also into Kubis. From there, there was a shootout before Kubis fled on bike. Heydrich's driver chased Gabčík on foot till he cornered him in a butcher shop. There, Gabčík turned around, shot him twice. And escaped, so he got away.
Oh, wow.
Gabčík and Kubis were shattered later. They did both get away. They were shattered later that the attack had failed. Only it hadn't. Heydrich was taken to hospital where it was found that he had suffered major diaphragm, spleen and lung damage. Oof. And a fractured rib. Hitler called him the man with the iron heart, but he could now be more accurately called the man with shrapnel in his spleen.
There it is.
Joke number two.
There's number two.
That's Maddie.
Maddie.
Which I guess
Maddie.
Is kind of similar. He died from his injuries a week later. So fucking suck it, you fuckhead.
A slow death.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
A slow death.
It's bad, isn't it? But I suppose he's so evil that you can feel good about his death.
As was the Nazis' MO, they reacted badly and they received dodgy intel that the assassins were from local villages Lidice and Lazaki. I'm so sorry, Czech people. The Nazis destroyed both villages, killing 5,000 people.
Oh, no.
And sending most of the rest to brutal Nazi concentration camps.
No.
Fuck. Wow. Fuck. That's awful.
Mm. Yeah. So that's, it's sort of like, yeah, there's no happy endings in this, but,
in World War II,
at least that got trapped.
Got trapped.
Is that what they say?
Yep.
There are many more missions, that I could talk about. The topic is obviously too big, but these are just two small missions inside. Well, I mean, these are two sort of prominent ones, but there are so many, should I talk about one more, or what do you think? Okay, yeah. It'll be quickish.
Yeah, okay, I reckon one more.
All right, I'll talk about one more, and I won't even use my words. There's a guy called Giles Milton who wrote a book about the SOE entitled
Excellent
The Ministry
name.
Of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Oh!
You know, which is, you know, totally about this topic. Giles did, yeah.
Fuck yeah, great name.
I bet he went to Oxbridge.
Yeah, I bet he did too. And I reckon because of this book, I don't know this for sure, but I think he maybe kind of popularized that term a bit more, and maybe the whole thing. I'm guessing that's why people are suggesting this topic with that name, is maybe because of this, I'm not sure.
Mm.
But anyway, I'm just going to read a little excerpt from...
A passage?
A little passage about one of the ministries, one of the chap's most important missions.
Mm.
So this is in the words of Giles Milton.
Thank you. Take it away, Giles.
It was a few minutes before midnight and the moon was glancing brightly off the deep snow. In the shadows of the ravine, 10 saboteurs could be seen clambering up the sides of a near vertical cliff, clutching at rocky outcrops and dangling spruce branches. He writes a lot of flowing prose.
That's beautiful.
It's
painting a picture. A
couple of rhymes in there.
Yeah.
Bit of Shakespeare.
In the distance was there...
Shakespeare.
Every time.
Never speak over Giles.
I'm so sorry,
Giles. One rule of... Giles.
You're right, sorry. Continue, please, Giles.
I am Giles, sorry. In the distance was their goal, the looming silhouette of the Norwegian Hydro-Norsk heavy water plant. This state-of-the-art factory was of vital importance to the Nazi war machine. The only place capable of producing the heavy water necessary for Hitler to build an atomic bomb. Its destruction was so crucial... to the Allied war...
You can do it.
I was going to say a fort. Its destruction was so crucial to the Allied war effort that Winston Churchill himself had ordered it to be given the highest possible priority. The stakes could not have been higher. If Hitler's scientists managed to build an atomic bomb, they would win the war. But if the factory could be destroyed, then Hitler's atomic ambitions would be at an end. For the mission, Gubbins, selected his Norwegian saboteurs. From men who had fled to England following the Nazi invasion of their country. Their leader was a bold 23-year-old named Rochem Ronenberg. He and his comrades were trained by two key members of Gubbins' inner circle, Eric Bill Sykes and William Shanghai Buster Fairbairn.
Oh my god, yes.
He's got two nicknames there, Shanghai Buster.
Shanghai Buster, that's his one nickname, he's the Shanghai Buster.
Fuck, that's good.
Who ran a secret killing school...
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no.
At Arasig House in the Scottish Highlands. That was one of the training camps for the...
Killing school.
But, yeah, it's...
Don't like that.
It's pretty... it's funny because all of this is, like, from one side, you're like, it's obviously written as if some of these people on the Allied team were obviously probably a bit fucked as well.
Mm.
Ronenberg's team was parachuted into the Hardinger Plateau. Landing in the teeth of an Arctic blizzard within striking distance of Norsk Hydro. Their sabotage mission got underway 10 days later under the cover of darkness.
Darkness.
I really like this Giles character you're putting on.
The saboteurs clambered down into the vertiginous gorge below Norse Kydro, and then began their treacherous ascent. Unseen by the guards, they reached the plant's perimeter fence, and after using bolt cutters to gain access, they split into two prearranged groups. One led by Ronenberg was to break into the plant and blow up the equipment. The other was to provide cover against the Gestapo attack. Ronenberg crept through the ventilation duct and attached the explosives. The charges that had been made at Brickentonbury Manor fitted like a glove, he later said. Good on him. The saboteurs were still inside the plant, their Sten guns trained on the German sentry posts when the explosives detonated. The sausage-shaped charges were fabulously destructive, imploding into the machinery and causing catastrophic damage. By the time the alarm was raised, the entire stock of Hitler's heavy water had drained away.
There was shards of wiener everywhere.
The Norsk Hydro mission was textbook guerrilla warfare, brilliantly planned and masterfully executed. Even the Germans were impressed. The commander of the German troops in Norway, General von Falkenhorst, expressed his admiration for the saboteurs' bravado, calling it the most splendid coup of the war. What?
What?
Hitler's atomic program had suffered a setback from which it would never recover. Jeez, I imagine Hitler wouldn't have loved that kind of feedback.
Especially when you use the English word splendid.
Yeah.
Well, I thought their coup was rather splendid, Hitler. Oh, dear. I shouldn't have said that. No. I shouldn't have said that to your face.
Anyway, that's the end of the report. I could have kept going and going.
Wow.
So many fascinating little stories in there across all of Europe and even in around Japan. And I'm always a bit wary of romanticizing war too much. I don't know if I've done that in this episode. Probably haven't.
Nah.
I think it's been some pretty real moments.
Yeah, but where are the fun facts?
They were all fun facts. Did you hear about all the explosions? The guy died. The evil guy died.
The gun that jammed.
Fun. That is fun.
Cigarette lighter gun.
That cigarette lighter gun was fun.
The underwater canoe.
I don't know. Hopefully Rowan's happy with those ones.
We just want Rowan to be happy.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
Look, I also want everyone to be happy.
No, I just want Rowan to be happy. Fuck everyone else.
Wow. And I'm happy, and that's all I care about.
Well, you're involved in my one too.
Great.
By extension.
Matt and I win.
You're part of everyone.
In a way.
To me, I am everyone, so.
But thanks, guys, for listening. Sorry if that was too brutal for you, Dave. I know you don't like some of that war history.
Mm. Yeah, I have never done a World War II topic on this show, apart from the Three Monties.
We've done a few war ones now. We also had Mad Jack.
We've done a few episodes.
We have done a few episodes. This is nice something.
Yeah.
Because we're coming up to the 100th episode. Ooh.
Yes, we are live September 16th. Get your tickets now.
I'm so excited.
Hey, we should, before we wrap up, we should probably thank a few of our Patreons.
I think we definitely should.
You should tell people how to do that too, Dave, if they want to do.
Well, if you want to support the show, say you've listened to every episode and you listen every week, then maybe you would like to give back to the show that gives you so much. you can head over
we
to...
We couldn't keep a straight face.
I know, sorry, I was really trying to be serious there, but I couldn't. You can head over to patreon.com/dogoonpod, and in exchange for different levels of pledges, you get different levels of reward.
You get different levels of pleasures.
Yes, and treasures.
Ooh,
including
and measures.
Bonus episodes, that's one of the treasures.
Mm-hmm.
Or we do updates and stuff on there. You can also pre-sales to live shows and stuff that we do. And also a shout out on the episode to say thank you to the individual people that keep the show running. And I would like to thank, if I could kick off.
Please do.
All the way from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
Georgia.
Where's that? America, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, not Georgia, the country.
Ah.
I'm assuming not. Not Georgia, next door to Russia.
Never know.
Could be.
Anyway, who's from Georgia?
I would like to thank, he's the shield of this show. It's Anthony Archield. Archield the shield.
He's our protector.
Oh, thank you,
thank you. Anthony, holding up the fort in Lawrenceville, Georgia. Appreciate your support. Mm. Thank you, Anthony. And I'd like to stay.
You're doing a lot of accidental rhymes.
To stay, if I may.
That was not accidental.
In the States. I'd like to thank... well, this person... I hope they're listening on Ormond Beach, because that's where they're
from. Please
stop. Ormond Beach. Oh, was that a rhyme again?
No, you're just the worst.
Jess really hates thanking people. She hates this segment so much.
Why do you hate it?
I don't hate it.
You do. You're so negative.
I love thanking people because I really, like, I think it's really amazing. But you are just so fucking, you can make a joke out of every single person's name and then I get to it. I'm like, thank you, Frank. You know, like,
what Dave's joke just then, the one that really pushed you over the edge was, I hope you're listening at the place you're from.
Which okay, is I'm sorry. Go.
Ormond Beach in Florida. I would like to thank, Noah Vol.
Oh man, there would have been a few Ormond Beach, Florida listeners sitting on the edge.
Is it me? But no, it's Noah.
I'm afraid unless you are Noah Vol, it is not your turn. But please keep waiting on that beach for us. And thank you to Noah Vol.
Good job, Noah. Can I go next?
Yes.
Great. Jess will be like, thank you too. Blah blah. Good night.
She's left. There she goes.
She's gone, bada bing, bada boom. Learn from a professional, kid.
No, it's not that I like thanking people. I just find it kind of stressful to make a joke or a pun with every single person. I would just like to genuinely thank people.
I legit just read out the beach he was from.
Okay, but that's a bad example because you I don't know. Anyway, keeping it within the States, interestingly, and within the Anthonys, because you had an Anthony.
I did, Anthony Archield, the Shield.
I also have an Anthony.
The Blue Wiggle.
Anthony the Blue Wiggle, my favourite of the Wiggles. But this Anthony is from Utah.
Give me two.
A Utah! Meatball!
Give me two. Great. What a great movie.
Oh, it's amazing.
What is that?
It's
Point Break.
Point Break.
Oh.
The original. I don't know. Maybe they said it in the new one. Another great cameo was by the Red Hot Chili Peppers singer in that. What's his
Anthony
name?
Anthony Kiedis. Also an Anthony.
Anthony.
He goes, but that would be a waste of time.
That's
one of my favorite movie quotes.
That's a good quote.
But that would be a waste of time.
Well, from that Anthony to this Anthony, I hope Anthony Fernelius.
Oh, that's the best Anthony name of all.
That's a pretty good name. I hope he's enjoyed Point Break and also Do Go On and supporting it.
Hey, Fernelius, give me two.
Meatball. Make it two.
Meatball.
Meatball.
And also, I would also like to thank from Texas.
Wow.
Not an Anthony.
Okay.
But a Naomi Chapman.
Oh, good name.
Great name.
Thank
she'd
you, Naomi.
She'd be a big fan of the Chaps.
Oh, yeah.
She's a big Chapman.
She's one of the original Chaps.
Yeah, I bet she was related to one of the Chaps. Maybe Gubbins.
I guarantee she is.
Gubbins changed his name to Chapman soon after the war.
You must.
Chapman for life.
So thank you, Naomi and Anthony, for listening and supporting the podcast.
Hey, I'd love it. I'd love to bring us back to the home front and thank someone from our capital territory, the Australian capital territory.
Canberra.
Well, that's inside the ACT. I don't know if I have time to explain everything about that, but I'd love to thank Laura Cotterill.
Laura.
Cotterill. My dad picks the fruit.
That goes to Cotterill.
Oh, I went to Codrell.
Yeah, Codrell. That's what I was thinking as well. That makes a lot more sense.
Doesn't make a lot more sense.
Than Cotties.
Yeah, well, I don't think Laura's giving me any sort of sick feeling, okay? Maybe if that sick feeling is the sick feeling of being supported by a friend of the podcast.
Or the sick feeling of drinking way too much cordial.
Yeah, I should have diluted it a bit
so
more.
So much. You just got to stop drinking it straight. Thank you,
Laura.
It
makes me feel alive. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
You're legend. I'd also love to thank, from San Diego, Wales, vagina, in California, Aaron Stossel. Aaron Stossel.
San Diego.
Which I've heard is an amazing place. My brother went there and said he just had the best time. He said it was fucking sick.
Is that your impression of your brother?
He needed Codrell afterwards.
Oh.
No, that was just my impression of... No, my brother would have said it like...
Tom.
He would have been more like, yeah, no, it was really great. Yeah, I had a really good time. Yeah, yeah.
But you knew what he meant.
I knew what he meant. What he meant was, fuck, it was fucking... It was hectic.
Bro.
Thanks, Aaron.
Aaron Stossel. I really like your name. I hope I'm saying it right. Yeah, thanks, Tom. He doesn't listen. My sister Alex does. Hey, Alex.
Hi, Alex. I know Alex.
All right, we all know Alex.
I'd like to say hi to Tom for when he finally gets around to listening.
Yeah, he'll get there eventually.
So that's great. I mean, I'm super blown away all the time. I write newsletters sporadically to the patrons, and I think I probably go on about it too much. But I'm so fucking blown away by the support.
Yeah.
of these mad dogs. You guys are the best. I think I love you.
Oh, wow, Matt. Be cool. Be
too
cool, be
soon.
Cool.
Okay,
play cool.
Play cool.
Hey, cool, cool, cool. All right. Aaron, I just thought maybe, you know, we could see, but maybe one day we could be mates.
There we go. Smooth.
I'm going to come to San Diego.
No. You're on too weird. Now okay. You can't turn up on his doorstep.
Okay.
If you're ever in San
Can
Diego.
I go to the Australian Capital Territory and visit Laura Cotterill?
No, you can't go to a house. It's
not a house. Maybe I just the word oh her, my God. Her territory.
And then I'm going to okay. piss in it. So now it's my territory. Like a dog. Yeah?
Yeah, like a mad dog.
All right, I'm going to wrap this up, guys.
Good call.
Thank you so much for listening, guys. If you want to get in contact or buy a ticket to our 100th show, the links are all in the description of this episode, but at DoGoOnPod for Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can drop us an email, suggest a topic. We love that. DoGoOnPod@gmail.com. But yeah, thanks so much for listening, guys. We'll be back with a new report next week. But until then, I will say... goodbye!
Later.
Bye!
This podcast is part of the Planet Broadcasting Network.
Visit planetbcasting.com for more podcasts from our great mates. I mean, if you want. It's up to you.
Danger! Danger!
Sydney sold out. Melbourne's on sale. Matt's coming to Brisbane.
High voltage!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.